This is a conversation with Jack Guthrie. We are at his office at Guthrie Mays Public Relations at 710 West Main Street in Louisville, Kentucky. It is June 14th, year 2000. My name is Ethel White. Okay, Mr. Guthrie, could we start with some little bit of biographical information? Your pre-University of Kentucky years.
There wasn't any pre-University of Kentucky, but if you really want to go back that far, it's hard sometimes. It's been a number of years. But I guess Louisville has always been home. Looking at a student at Trinity High School, I don't think you want to go back further than that one.
That's Trinity's fine.
And that's sort of where I got involved in journalism, like a lot of other young people, I'm sure, working on the school newspaper and just being part of the extracurricular activities, and really enjoyed, it was a newspaper called The Echo, which today still has a great reputation for assisting, you know, young high school journalists that go on to college, and I'm very proud of what Trinity has done. Around that same time, I guess I also sort of made a nuisance of myself at the Voice of St. Matthews. And it was a fellow by the name of Emil Ahn, A-U-N-N, I believe, who was the editor of The Voice at that time, and it was owned by a fellow by the name of Shansberg. And they had invited me to do sports stories on Trinity's athletic activities. But I also wanted to do more, just to learn how the business worked, and to, you know, it's a little part-time job. So they, in order not to make a nuisance of myself, they invited me in, and they let me write obits, and they let me write small news columns about what was going on in the different cities around the area, and do their filing and their clipping. You know, whatever they wanted done, sweep the floor, I would do. And they paid me 10 cents a column inch. So I used to write a lot, if I could, to try to, at the end of the every two-week period, I get to count up my inches. And then I went, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. As a lot of, I guess, young people graduating from high school, and especially back in 1958, you know, the world was it was a much larger place in many ways, students at that time, you didn't know there was such a big world out there that you could deal with. Your world was really local. And from a financial standpoint, I did not have the resources to go away to school. But my friends then were, a lot of them were going to Bellarmine, so I decided to go to Bellarmine. And spent 2 years there and enjoyed it very much, and worked on the college paper there. As it was then, it's called the Concord. The Bellarmine Concord. And I remember turning in a paper to a Franciscan priest who was an English teacher, and he gave it back to me, and he said, you know, see me on it. So I went to see him, and he said, this is well done, but it's not what I'm looking for as an English theme. He said, you need to go to journalism school. He said, I think that would better serve your writing ability than possibly either majoring in English or accounting, or, you know, I was going to be an accounting major, I was going to be a dentist, I was, you know, you were going to be everything back then. And I told him, I said, I have no idea, where is their journalism school? And he didn't know either. So I went out to the University of Louisville to see, and found out that they didn't have a program. And my older sister was a graduate student at UK, and she was living in Frankfurt. And one weekend, she said, you know, I think UK has got a journalism school. I'll look into it. So sure enough, they did. And I caught a Greyhound bus up in Shelbyville Road and Breckenridge Lane. It used to stop. And so I caught a bus to ride to Lexington, and she picked me up at the Greyhound station in Lexington, and we went to visit the campus, and sort of the rest of it is history. So I did, they didn't want to let me in, though. They almost didn't let me in, but I managed to get there. And that's where I became involved with the Kentucky Colonel.
And this was your junior year?
It would have been my junior year. I was one of those five-year wizards. Because when I transferred, I lost about a semester in there with philosophy and some theology credits and some things that the state university wasn't too fond of at that time of taking as transfer credits. And when they offered me the editorship of the Colonel, I had to agree to stay the whole year. There was not, I mean, if I wanted to be editor, so I just lightened my load my senior year. And I probably needed every credit, though, that I could get by that time. And so in losing the one semester and then picking up some time in order to work on the Colonel, and we were publishing 4 days a week at that time. We published a daily Monday, Tuesday. Well, I'll take that back. It came out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And so we did not publish a Monday edition. Now they're publishing 5 days a week. We were publishing 4 days a week, and that was still considered a daily on a college campus.
Did you start immediately with the Colonel?
Oh, we started writing because I started writing because I was a journalism, you know, major. But no, I was just a staff writer for my first semester of my junior year, and then the second semester, I remember I was made what they called. Well, let me back up a little bit. I'll say that even though I was a junior on their books because of the transfer things, I was really a sophomore, okay, because I was going to spend 3 years at UK. So that first year, I was just writing, you know, like any of the other students, whatever assignments that were given on any campus activity, and I would do anything just to stick around. It was a fun thing to do, and I had ink in my blood or something. And then the next year, fortunately, was asked to be what we call the daily editor. We had a staff for each day that we published. And you had a individual that headed that particular day's staff, so I was one of those. I was the Wednesday editor. and then there was what we called a campus editor, or a city editor, and a managing editor, and a regular editor above it. There were about six people above there that were every day, and then each day had its staff. And then after my junior year, you had to apply, and there were, I know at least two of us, and maybe three, that had applied to the director of the school. And I was fortunate enough to be the one selected to be editor for the year 1962-1963. And that's where the college part of it, or the editorship in college, began.
Okay. Well, why don't we start or continue with your telling the story of the Kentucky Colonel and civil rights.
Okay.
And then we'll follow up with some questions.
Okay.
How did it get started?
There were
start at the beginning.
There were a number of us that made up that, I guess, the permanent members, if you will, the student body. And we met, some of us met over the summer. My managing editor, who was my best friend and still is for that matter, and Dick Wilson, who has just recently retired from the Courier-Journal. And you were looking, you know, what kind of issues will we want to be involved with in the fall? You know you're going to have your normal campus activities and sports activities, but I think we all felt that the world was changing, society was changing, and how might we make a difference? What could we see that we wanted to leave some kind of legacy of that particular year? And there were some things that were happening in the country at that time. The civil rights movement was beginning to emerge. There were the demonstrations, there were the, if you remember, after the 60 Olympics, when Cassius Clay, now Muhammad Ali, came back to Louisville, he could not be served in some of the restaurants in his own hometown. And as college students, while we were aware, we probably weren't, it didn't affect us that much, but I remember being, when we got back to campus that fall, and in some of our discussions, we looked into it and found that the African Americans, at that time, Negroes who were attending the University of Kentucky. While we had not seen any, what we'd say, discrimination, it was probably because we didn't look. And we began to ask some questions around campus and found out there were some of
the fall of 62.
Would be the fall of 62.
Okay.
That there were some things going on and around campus that we certainly, as a college newspaper, thought needed to be addressed and commented on locally, as well as things that were happening at other schools. You may remember there was a fellow by the name of James Meredith who was trying to get admission to the University of Mississippi. And the governor of Mississippi at that time stood on the steps, Governor Ross Barnett, and refused that young man entry into the University of Mississippi. The University of Kentucky had been integrated since 1949, and it was done very peacefully. It was done by court order. The university welcomed a suit that was filed by Dr. Lyman Johnson. And it really never went to trial. It was decided, or let's say it never went to a jury trial, went to trial. And the judge ruled in favor of Dr. Johnson. And I think in the summer of 49, Lyman Johnson, along with some other students, African-American students, entered the university. And that we were proud of that fact, but still there needed to be done. And here we were 11 years, not even that, what, 9 years later, close to it. And so we found out, we did stories at that time about housing discrimination around campus, people that might not rent student housing, off-campus housing, to African-Americans, to restaurants that they found out that they could serve, they could go in and buy something and take it out, but they could not eat it at the counter in the restaurant. So we did a survey. I remember that was one of the, probably the first thing we did. We did a survey of students and found out a lot of the students didn't know. And after we told them, were sort of appalled by the findings and felt that, for the most part, that these students deserved the same right as any other student. So slowly but surely, the segregation barriers began to drop around the campus, and probably more slowly than we had liked, but it was a beginning. And then James Meredith, and then civil rights activities throughout the country. You know, and at that time, too, talking about college students' interest, there was something else going on, and it was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was a whole other issue, which we wanted to try to get our readers, if you will, our students, to look beyond their little world and what else might affect them out there. Certainly the integration issue was an important one. But I remember distinctly going back to actually my fraternity house and watching one night, all of us sitting around watching President Kennedy talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis and what would bearing would that have on us, especially seniors, you know, and the draft was looking you right down the pike. So there were a lot of things going on. And part of this then, we got into discussing the athletic situation. And there were articles being written about many outstanding black athletes in the South were going to universities to the North. They were going to Michigan State, Syracuse, Ohio State, maybe Indiana, wherever that they might go, but they were not going to Southeastern Conference schools. So that sort of is where we started another, and I think probably the most important move that we made at that time, was to both editorially as well as from a news standpoint, cover the university's position and what would they do if we demanded and the students demanded that African Americans be allowed to play organized sports for the university.
Could you take just a minute to describe what the situation was in the SEC?
There were no, of all of the teams, across, whether it be basketball, football, you name it. To my knowledge, and I'm sure it was true, there were no black athletes that participated in any intercollegiate athletics. Whether there were any intramural athletics, I don't know, but competing against the other schools.
Was there a written rule?
No, we didn't find one. It seemed to be an unwritten rule. And
What we looked at back then, again, sort of an editorial staff that we had, and there were probably five or six of us that were part of that team, if you will. The NCAA finals in basketball were going to be held in Louisville in March. So we thought this would be a perfect opportunity to make the statement and sort of start a campaign to allow African Americans to be part of the total college experience and to play. So we began doing our homework, and a lot of that encompassed, working with the advisor to the colonel at that point, his name I know well, and it'll come to me in a minute, and I'll bring it back up.
Louis Donahue.
Louis Donahue, you got this. Dr. Donahue, who was not doctor then, it was Mr. Donahue, who was sort of the faculty advisor. So I remember we had a conversation with him that we wanted to launch a editorial effort on this behalf. And to his credit, I believe, and he did this one of most things, he said, as long as you've got your facts and your figures and you've done your homework, I'll support that effort. So we did that, and we also knew we had to get our message outside of just the Lexington area. We just couldn't publish on the campus. We needed to reach out beyond Lexington, or it just might fall on deaf ears. So Dick Wilson and I rode in to Louisville one, either Saturday or Sunday, and we met with John Ed Pierce. John Ed Pierce at the time was the editorial page editor of the Courier Journal. And we knew Mr. Pierce from touring the building, or touring the Courier at some point during our J-school career, and he was also a University of Kentucky graduate, and we met him at his house. And we told him of our plan, and we said, if we go through with this, will the Courier support us? And he asked us if we'd had lunch, and we had not, and he gave us $5 or whatever, probably not that then, probably $3, and said, why don't you guys go have lunch someplace and come back? So we did, and when we got back to his house, he handed us on something he had just pulled out of the typewriter. He said, how's this? And it was an editorial, his first draft, of the Courier's support of the UK student newspaper demanding that the university either admit black athletes or get out of the Southeastern Conference. And he said, there's work to be done, and I want to see the drafts that you all have. And he said, I will support you. So while we were gone, he had knocked that out. I suspect he probably made a few phone calls. So that was, we felt very good about that, by having, you know, the Courier Journal at that time, and in some instances, you know, stuck in some places today, but it was certainly what I thought of. It was a major daily newspaper to be reckoned with in this country. And if you got that support, we knew it then would carry beyond the hallowed boundaries of Fayette County. But we went back in there. We also, a few of us had developed a friendship with a gentleman by the name of Kelso Sturgeon. And Kelso was a sports writer for the Associated Press. And we told Kelso about pending plant attack, and he agreed to put it on the wire for us. And what we did, we published it. Now, you know, we'd work during the day. The paper would go on the press about somewhere around 8 to 10 o'clock, depending. So, and then be distributed for people to pick up the next morning. So we gave, anytime we did a story, we provided it that night to Kelso Sturgeon, who could put it on the AP Sports Wire.
He did it anyway? I mean, aside from this particular issue?
Yes. Oh, no, this was the issue. We were
on this issue.
I mean, if he wanted to pick up something else that we may have written on some other sports issue, fine, but we were doing it on this, you know, particular matter. So that was another way to, again, get the message out beyond the borders of Lexington. And we timed it so that the first story and very first editorial hit toward the end of March the 23rd, if I remember correctly, because the NCAA, the coaches or the athletic directors were meeting at Louisville before the beginning of the national championship. Yeah, that began the week before is when they met, and then you had your national championship. So we knew we'd have all of the, if you will, decision makers, at least those who could impact or impact, have an influence on the decision, not only of SEC schools, but every major school in the country would be there. And the Courier picked up the stories, picked up our editorial, and the ball sort of, you know, like a snowball once that got rolling. And we continued. There were maybe four or five different editorials, a series of...
Go ahead.
There were a...
Snapped off for a minute.
A series of articles. What other schools were doing in Kentucky. And there were other Kentucky schools that had been integrated for some time. So we told our story. And realizing that, you know, this was the end of March and the 1st of April, and boards of trustees had to meet. Most of us were seniors. School was going to be out the end of May, 1st of June. So
So the window to get something accomplished was very narrow, but the message, it sort of, as I said, that snowball got rolling. And to make a long story short, the newspaper followed through. The University Board of Trustees, while they weren't sure how it was going to work, President Dickey came out and made the comment that he supported black athletes playing in the Southeastern Conference. And it took a few years for it to happen. But it did come to pass. And today, obviously, we know, you know, I don't know what percentage, but certainly in football and basketball, a very large percentage of the young men and young women, too, on the women's basketball teams are African American, and have done a great job. And we owe them a great deal. And some of our finest athletes certainly have come from the black community.
Okay, let's see if we can just talk about some of these sub-issues, I guess, sub-questions. First of all, when you were discussing, you and your staff were discussing this issue over the summer, do you remember anything about the way those discussions went? In other words, was there any hesitation on anyone's part to tackle with civil rights issues? Were there any considerations to be dealt with as far as maybe it wasn't a good idea? I mean, do you remember what the considerations
were? If there was,
were?
No, if there was, I don't recall anybody saying it was either not a good idea. I'm sure we knew, if you will, that there was some risk involved, but seniors in college and journalism students, risk was our middle name. We loved it. And I think it gave us a purpose of being, it gave us a way to make a difference, it gave us a way that we wanted to impact the student body, and it was a cause we all believed in. And we were determined, I mean, there was certainly, there was nobody that quit the staff. I don't remember, you know, it's been a long time, but any really disagreements. The only thing was, how do we do it, and how do we go about it? And, of course, during the time, we got some interesting hate mail from around you know, the state as well as around the region, because when the story was picked up by the Associated Press and sent out across the country, some of the letters that arrived, it was amazing to me. I'm just, well, maybe the same. Unfortunately, there's still some of it out there today, the racism that existed. But at the same time, while we were getting some hate mail, and some from journalists, which was even, you know, I remember one that came in from a paper in Jackson, Mississippi, who basically said, you know, if the University of Kentucky wants to let Negroes play, fine, let them get out of the SEC. We don't need those people in our sports programs. And this was a newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi. And it's interesting to note that the current editor, I mean, news editor, I guess executive editor, they call him, the Courier Journal, is a man by the name of Denny Avery, who is African American and came from the same newspaper. So a lot of water has gone over the dam, you know, much for the better in that time. But we did get some nationwide and worldwide attention. We had faculty that were interested in supporting us. We had students. We had those that didn't. But we printed every letter to the editor that came in, no matter what was said. We felt if we had the right to express our opinions, our student and fellow students should have the right to express theirs.
So you published racial epithets and everything else?
Everything. And I don't remember any, you know, any problem with that. I wondered at the time, and Lewis Donahue, who was the moderator, probably took a lot of heat, maybe from others on campus. But the Colonel, we were very proud of that student newspaper. It was known as one of the top college newspaper, if you will, of the South, if you want to be classified in that way. But there were some very outstanding newspapers. We had won seven William Randolph Hearst Awards that year. Couple of them for our integration series, but for other writings too. The top college newspapers, the Daily Nebraskan was a big one, I remember. The Daily Texan was a big one. The Tar Heel of North Carolina. We were among the top 10 college newspapers in the country. And I think that's another thing that made us proud of that fact, and we were going to maintain the reputation of the quality of journalism. And a lot of the young people, can say that now with a gray in my hair, but that came out of there had gone on to make a pretty good, you know, name for themselves in different professions, and many of them in the journalism profession. So we were all proud to be part of the Kentucky Colonel and proud of the statement we made that made a difference. Even though Kentucky, I'd have to go do some homework. We did have we were not the first one to have a black athlete. If I recall, it was Tennessee. And, you know, I was in service, and after getting out of service, starting a career, and you sort of lose track, because I had left Kentucky at that time. I was working in New York. But about 2 years later, there was a black football player at Tennessee. And then there was Adolph Rupp had recruited a black basketball player. And it did not work out with that young man, both grade-wise, and he also had some other problems. And that sort of soured the university a little bit at that point. Yeah, they felt, you know, was Adolph a racist? I don't think he was. I honestly don't think he was. People forget the times we were living in. If you want to say, if he was living today and doing maybe some of the things he did then, you might consider him a racist. But he was from Kansas. His high school team that he coached had black athletes on it. But he did have that Kansas Southern draw, he used, and he did not have a black athlete. And I think he sort of got the short end of the stick. We did not hear anything from Adolph. I don't remember getting a quote from him, but it was Bernie Shively, who was the athletic director at the time, which is who properly should have commented, was Bernie Shively and the president of the university and the board of trustees. That's who we were going after, not the coach. You know, you had to change policy. And there seemed to be a fear, or an excuse, maybe a little bit of both, that Kentucky would say, well, we don't want to recruit a young black athletes who might have to go down to Georgia and Alabama, Florida, wherever, Louisiana, to play basketball because of some of the abuse they might be subjected to. And I thought there was, leave that up to the student, but that Kentucky should do the right thing. And there were some schools that said they wouldn't play us. And we said, if they won't play us, and we should get out. So it was an interesting battle at the time.
The emphasis that was in the articles that you gave me to look at by the UK officials was they were afraid that they would lose money. And then there was something about values that I'm not sure I understood. I don't remember seeing anything about what might happen to the black athletes who would go down there. And I'm sure it was in something else.
Right.
But the emphasis that I noticed was, you know, let's go slow. We don't want to, I guess, lose some sort of donations. There was something about bondholders in the Coliseum.
I guess, and that probably was very true, and if I look back through it, and as students at that time, you know, we just said, we looked beyond that. But as trustees, that was probably something proper for them to address.
But this wasn't anything that anyone came directly to you about.
No.
Did anyone try to quiet you down?
No. They did not. And whether they approached the director of the school, or whether they approached the moderator, if so, I was not aware of it. And in fact, just about 6 months, 8 months ago, maybe last September, October, I had an opportunity to talk with Dr. Frank Dickey, who was president at the time. And we were at a luncheon. He's retired, living in Lexington, and still, you know, active. And I said, Doctor, I said, there was one thing I've always wanted to ask. I never had an opportunity. And told him, you know, do you recall the integration series that we did? And he said, yes. I said, did you get much objection? Did you get many calls from university family? And he said, no. He said, surprisingly, he said, my calls were from other institutions around the SEC, of their concern over it, and not really our own faculty and staff as much as others. That sort of made me feel good about that the university was willing to do what was right and stand up for it. I'm looking at an editorial here that it seems that the Mississippi State did say that they would not play an integrated team at home, in reference back at their home. That they might play up here. But it's interesting to see, it says the University of Georgia is almost certain to take the same position. Let's see, that they would play integrated teams at home or away. Vanderbilt and Tulane both replied that they would play integrated teams. So far, Mississippi State, which UK at that time didn't play in football down there, replied that it would not play an integrated team at home. The other schools have reserved comment.
I think it's interesting in looking through some of this I haven't seen for a while, even though my little scrapbook that I've got all of this material. It's an editorial in the Courier said that the University of Kentucky could lead the conference and that the trustees should take action and vote at their next meeting. This was appeared in March, the end of March, so it would have been an April trustee meeting to do away with segregation and to allow black athletes. And UK President Frank Dickey said he favored integrated athletics, but he adds that the university's obligation to the holders of the bonds of Stoll Field and Memorial Coliseum must be considered. Were the bonds sold under the condition that the university would maintain Jim Crow athletic teams? If not, he must mean that if the university is dropped from the conference, it would have trouble working out schedules and attendance at football and basketball games. That would come into place. And that would be true. that the university, because they shared revenue, so from a financial standpoint, that had to come into play back then. And if we had gotten out of the SCC, where would we go? And how would we do it if we got to an independent? You don't share conference proceeds. So there were other issues that had to be considered, but the leadership that we saw from Dr. Dickey and Bernie Shively and others, whether they sort of bit their tongue or not, at least Dr. Dickey said no, it was the right thing to do, and he supported it.
Well, I did want to ask you, that brings up the issue of, you know, the impatience of youth versus the caution of the adult world. I mean, the UK didn't want, you know, said it would not withdraw from the SEC, but it would work for the desegregation of it. Then somebody named Tom Seiler in Street and Smith Football said that the SEC race issue might have remained dormant if it hadn't been for the Colonel. You had newspapers like the Courier Journal who were on your side. As you look back from the point of view of the year 2000, what do you think? I mean, were you right to push for it? Were they right to say go slow? Was it a matter of a push-pull that was necessary in order to move things along?
It probably would have eventually happened because of the country itself and what was happening. The civil rights movement was in full swing. So if anything, I think by the colonel's nudging early on that the university, and i.e. then the state of Kentucky, was able once again to make an easier transition into allowing African Americans into the mainstream of our athletics and other programs. Not that the state of Kentucky or UK or somebody have made some mistakes along the way. We all have. But I do think we acknowledged what was right. We were the first Southeastern Conference school to integrate our classrooms. So it only was right that we were the first to integrate, at least in saying we would, even if we might not have been the first to put a young man or woman on a court or a football field.
You were the first SEC school to integrate the classrooms, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That was back in 1949 with Dr. Johnson.
Oh, that, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
Because here, if you looked at it, James Meredith, in the fall of 62, was standing, you know, was being turned away by gunpoint from the University of Mississippi. And there was a lot of problems.
Were you in contact with any, either as a result of your editorial about James Meredith, or as a result about your articles and editorials about the SEC integration? Were you in contact with any of the other campus newspapers around the country? Do you remember?
I'll tell you, not in the fact, you know, it's so easy today between with email and telephones, and, you know, at that time you've made long-distance phone call, you might have been calling the moon. No, we had exchange programs with our paper that we'd send around, and I do remember a number, three or four, if they were mailed back to us, if we were able to find them, but of other schools, and I remember LSU, the editor at LSU, was one who did a column that endorsed what the colonel was asking for. And I'm sure there were some other Southern schools that probably did the same thing, as well as there were, might have been. I don't remember any other student publication being against it.
But it wasn't the right time in the world for you to pick up the phone and call, say, LSU and say, what's it like down there and what's your newspaper doing?
Today we probably would.
You didn't do that kind of thing then.
But you sort of didn't do it. Maybe we weren't sophisticated enough to think about it at that point. What we did do, of course, we did a total review, and I remember personally of talking with presidents and athletics directors throughout the state of Kentucky. We did a large, it was about a page and a half, feature story on a capsule of what each university was doing. And we found we were the only ones that were the holdout there. And the excuse was, again, well, we're playing in the South. So the University of Louisville had black athletes, and there was rumor at the time, and probably the man is certainly still with us today, it would be interesting to ask him, that Wes Unsell, who became an All-American at U of L, and All-American pro and is coached in the pros, that he was recruited by the University of Kentucky, but declined because he did not want to be the first. He did not want to be the one to break the barrier, which if you think about it, it's tough enough being in college and playing college athletics, much less if you had to take some abuse around, and he stayed at U of L and did very well. But there were some other colleges, yes, that did support us. But no, we did not pick up the phone, and I guess our world, besides we were seniors, we still had to graduate, we had to get into things, and we were wanting to make sure our message continued to get out. But
Do you remember any of the people you talked to on the campus, on the UK campus? I know it's been a long time.
No, I really don't.
Do you remember talking to any of the black students? Remember,
you know, it's
did?
A shame. I don't. I mean, I'm not sure that our staff and whatever, and the sports editor and whatever may have. There were a lot of us that were part of the equation.
Of course, you were the editor, and
yeah,
other people
I was,
were
and
out.
Other people were out. And then, and it was not a, you know, this was certainly not a one-person thing. There were, it was a team of us that that made it happen.
There were a couple of allusions to your being on radio or television or both. Do you remember any appearances?
No, I really, there might have been some radio interviews, and I remember reading about those, and my memory is does not recall those, unfortunately.
The other thing I noticed was, and if you want me to pause the tape so you can look at it to refresh your memory, I will do that. But I noticed that there was a letter that you sent me, a letter from Martin Luther King. And in that letter, I don't believe he made any comment about your series. But what he wanted was money.
Was money. I think all of a sudden we got on a few mailing lists from the Southern Leadership, Christian Leadership Conference, and I think, you know, well, we just got on some mailing list of looking at, well, maybe this is a, you know, a liberal student newspaper, and we should, I remember there was a society, a liberal group known as Students for Democratic Action. I've forgotten what university, where it started, but I remember they paid a visit to me at the university, and we walked over to a little snack shop and sat down and had a cup of coffee or something, and they were interested in us editorializing for that particular cause. And I said, well, you know, you've got, there's certain things mixed up here, you know, especially with this individual who I guess, while I might be socially liberal in looking at what needs to be done, it's the right thing to do, I'm probably still a conservative at heart. But they had a number of socialist issues that they wanted us to join their forces on that. And I think we just got on some mailing list at that point. So I don't remember any other particular things.
Well, now there was an aftermath where your advisor was replaced by another advisor.
That was an interesting.
Could you talk about what happened and speculate as to why?
And that's what all it would be with it. That would be speculation. I think it's probably pretty good speculation.
All right. First of all,
from an authoritative source.
All right. What happened, first of all?
The fellow that was going to succeed me as editor of the Kernel was Dick Wilson. The moderator, Dr. Lewis Donahue, he was going on to graduate school at either Iowa or Iowa State. So there was going to be a new faculty moderator. And, you know, at that time I was gone, but Dick and I were very close, and I remember getting a letter from him, and I was in boot camp. And he was talking about a gentleman they brought in from Winchester, Kentucky. He was editor, I think, of the Winchester Sun, who was a retired publisher who they being the university, was going to retain as the faculty moderator for the Kernel. And Dick would have to tell you the story for sure, but I remember he and Dick met, and basically one thing he did, there was a suite, not suite, there were offices and a couple of rooms that we as students used as newsrooms. Well, he moved all the students out over into one big typing room, what a computer room, typing room, with manual typewriters, you know, Smith Coronas. And he took over the editor's office as his office. He took over the newsroom as his reception room. and took over what was the sports editor's office as his conference room. Put all the students, and he had told Dick, and I feel this was correct, that there would be no more nigger news reported in the Kentucky Colonel, and that he was now the publisher, and he would make sure that it was run his way. And I'm writing Dick from, you know, you didn't pick up the phone then, and telling Dick, you know, throw him out. Move the furniture out in the hall. Demonstrate. Do whatever you need to do, but he's got to go. Because you can't. Bill Kaywood, Kaywood was his last name. I remember Kaywood was his last name. William Kaywood, I think, but Kaywood was his last name. And I don't know the details. You know, it's easy for me to be sitting 600 miles away and then, you know, in the military, etc., so you can't keep track. But Dick, to my knowledge, was the only editor of the Kentucky Colonel that never published an issue. He resigned in protest. And there was a woman that by the name of Sue Endicott, who had was a journalism student, and she became editor, I guess, and agreed in some sort to at least try to do what she could as far as under the new regime.
Did the university hire Kaywood?
Well, that's you know, it's yes, I'd have to say somewhere they did. Whether it was the director of the school, how Dick Wilson would have to recall that. Then there was a whole time where there was a demand for the newspaper to go independent, to remove itself from the journalism school, as far as being published, if you will, by the university. And you can see, if it, you know, you could argue either side of the coin, but it's a publication of the university. Should the university have more say on what goes in it? Well, my answer is no. That's a student learning workshop. And but there were a number of papers at that time that around the country that over the next, from about 1963 to 1973, set up independent boards, if you will. And while they might have still been associated with the schools, were at arm's length. And that is still true today at UK. The Kentucky Colonel is still an important part of the journalism program, but it is actually an independent entity, much like the Athletic Association is independent. The Alumni Association is independent. You have dotted lines to the university, but legally, you are a separate entity. And they set up their own board of advisors. There was a woman by the name of Nancy Green who was worked on Nancy Lowridge at the time, who was a student when I was, who sort of became a moderator of the first independent Colonel. And there were some bumpy roads for a few years for the Colonel and other papers around the country because of the war issue. Was, you know, he not only had the integration or whatever, might have been a few of us fighting that battle, but you also then had Vietnam heating up. And I'm sure you had student newspapers making editorial stances, et cetera, in that regard. But I was removed from it and not directly involved. And then what came along was Kent State. There was just a whole lot, you know, going on in that 63 to 73 time period.
Well, I just wondered whether the university had become gun-shy as a result of the issues that the Colonel had raised and decided to try to quiet things down a little bit, or whether it was just circumstantial.
I think unofficially, I would say they probably became a little gun-shy. However, I think the seeds had been planted. The movement was underway. You had a new president at the time. Now, there was another thing that started. There was, because Dr. Dickey had resigned to take a position in Washington, and you had Dr. John Oswald, who came to the university from the California system. He was a chancellor or so out in California. I do remember an interesting story of, I was a six-month wonder in the military, so I didn't last very long, but after getting out of service, about January of 64, I came back to Lexington and worked for a few months before moving to New York. But, and when you came back, you know, the first place you'd go to reestablish, you know, friends and see what was going on, I received a letter from Dr. Oswald inviting me as a former editor of the Colonel to meet with him to discuss some planning that was being done on how to best set up an independent paper or a, you know, a new structure, if you will, for the newspaper. And at the time, still, we had Bill Kaywood. The name is, you know, who was the moderator. It was an interesting day. There were about, one afternoon, I was in the journalism school. I'd never met him. Didn't want to meet him. But that afternoon, by complete happenstance, there were three or four farmer editors that happened to show up on the same day. And we weren't there for the same reason that I know of. We just sort of happened to go in, and he thought the conspiracy, I mean, he was on his way out, man. He got off. It did shake him up a little bit.
And he thought it was deliberate?
He thought it was deliberate. That all of us were ganging up against him. And I think he only lasted that 1 year, if I'm correct. He didn't last beyond that 1 year. Because he was suppressing, you know, student news. He was just not the man for the job. But he sure caused chaos and caused one of the best future journalists not to ever edit the Courier. And David Hopp then at the Courier, who now is editorial chief of the Courier, he was sort of a sophomore when we were juniors, seniors. So David was part of that. What was coming behind us were also strong student leaders and strong student journalists. A fellow by the name of Bill Grant was in there. That we weren't, you know, they weren't going to give up. We were proud not only of just, well, of the Colonel, not only of its stance on integration, but of its independence and what that school had taught us to be. We were not going to let somebody take that over. So I remember getting this letter from Dr. Oswald wanting to have this conversation. So I went on campus and I set up the meeting. And before going to the meeting, though, made some stops on campus to see what had gone on while I was away. And I remember seeing there was an anthropology professor who was just a neat guy and a good friend. It was one of my sources when I was editor. And I went to see him, explained, I said, let me tell you why I'm here and what I'm looking for and what the new president has asked me for. And after I explained it, he said, Jack, he's blowing smoke. He said, the decision's been made. And I said, what? He said, all he's trying to do is make things look good. He's just trying to pad it. He said, and he opened his desk drawer, and he said, read this. And he handed me a sheet of paper, and on it was an outline that had been adopted by the university senate or somebody. It was a letter or a memo from the president on the new structure of the Kentucky Colonel. I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, he's just, you know, he'll talk to all of you, and then he'll make his decision, and he will make you all part of that decision. I said, I'll be damned. So I went over to see him. Well, the gentleman said, he said, here, you can have this. He was on a committee that ended up getting a copy of it. So I went over to see the good Dr. Oswald, never met him. And during our course of the conversation, I was sitting in a chair in front of his desk, and he was telling me he was just exploring different methods of college journalism and how the newspaper, you know, on and on and on. I said, well, I understand this, that, and that. He was not confirming it at all. And I reached into my coat pocket and I said, but how do you explain this? And he said, where did you get that? Where did you get that? You're not supposed to have that, or something to that effect. And I said, I'm proud to be a graduate of this university's journalism school. And if I couldn't come on this campus and get some information prior to coming in this office, I didn't learn much. And he's, Miss Wilson, who was his secretary, show this man out of here. So I have the prerogative, I guess, of being thrown out of the president's office in the spring of 1964. And I guess I'm part sort of proud of that fact. So that was the end of my conversation with Dr. Oswald. And then I spent 6 years in New York, and you know, you're busy starting a career, starting a family, while you're keeping touch and you try to know what's going on. The war was raging in the Vietnam. Student interest was in the streets on that. But Kentucky and Appalachia, I mean, it did happen. And I think there was a young football player, and I'd have to go look up his name to see who was the first black athlete to start for a University of Kentucky program. But even today, I think it speaks well for the university. You have a gentleman in C.M. Newton who led the integration of Alabama in its basketball program when he became coach
basketball coach down there. And Bear Bryant was football coach, but they did begin to recruit black athletes. And obviously we have in Tubby Smith, an outstanding gentleman. We had a African-American in, what's Maddox? Can't remember her first name. Coach Maddox is the women's coach. So a lot of progress, still a lot to be done, but a lot of progress made. And I was I think all of us that were involved in the Colonel at that time were glad to be part of it and think we did hopefully have something to do with starting it.
Let me just ask you one or two more things, and that is, there were a couple of editorial writers. Somebody named Stephen Palmer wrote the editorial about James Meredith. Do you remember anything about, for instance, was he specifically an editorial writer?
Yes. Steve was an editorial writer.
Did you make the assignments?
Oh, boy. Think of the editor. We'd sit around and talk about it, and whoever had the time, you write this one, you write that one, or depending on maybe what your interest may have been. Steve, I believe at that time, was also in law school, and I'm looking at him here, and that was his, if you will, his contribution to the Colonel was to be an editorial writer. There were some other ones. What other names did you?
Well, somebody named Peter Jones, who was apparently from New Jersey.
Yes, that's the name I was trying to think of.
Was
Peter.
The one who wrote the editorial about withdrawing from the SEC.
Peter was assigned that particular editorial to write, and he was the one that did it. Peter is now working in New York on a Scholastic magazine, I think, and still in journalism, still available. And I haven't seen Peter since we both left. But
do you remember if you had any particular considerations about why you would pick somebody to write an editorial, or was it just a matter of, I think, somebody's turn and they had the time?
No, I think probably the way we did it at that time, somebody that really had an interest and somebody that wanted to do it, you had to feel, I think, especially an editorial. Now, there were other editorials. Yeah, I'll take the one, I'm going to do the one on the, the homecoming deal, and somebody else is going to do the welcome back to campus. I mean, it's simple. But if you had something that you felt very passionately about, you would select, and we would talk about what's our position on it. In other words, it's not that editorial writer. We did not sign our editorials. So it was the staff, or the editor's staff, that made the decision on what the position should be. And then that particular writer would try their hand at writing it that way. And then it would be turned in. Some of them, we would edit, some we would not, depending. But we were all pretty much of the same mind, I think. And we had come up the two previous years. We'd sort of all grown up, and that was our... I don't know, it was a community, a family itself. You'll find, I don't know whether it's true at other universities, I would think it was, that you spent more time working on the college newspaper than you did anything else besides going to class, and you became very, very close, and it was your own social organization as well. So all of those people we drink beer with and run around with, but it was Peter Jones that did write the initial one.
Also, do you have an idea as to why, you make sure that you fed the articles to the man at the American Associated Press, who then had the ability to send it around the world, but do you have any idea why what the Colonel was doing captivated as many people as it did? In other words, it seemed to have made quite a splash.
I think it made quite a splash, but because of the timing, too. Because of the NCAA and it being held in Kentucky, the finals that year. I'd have to go look and see who played in it that year. That would have been 63, I'm not sure offhand, but there were undoubtedly black athletes that were going to be on that basketball court. You had columns. This was the one, I said, in Jackson, Mississippi. Who was this? Or no, that's the Commercial Appeal. I think that's somewhere in Mississippi. No, it's Columbus, Mississippi, where it says maybe Kentucky should leave SEC for Negroes. And it's, we see where the editor of the UK student newspapers advocated the withdrawal of the university from the Southeastern Conference for the express purpose of recruiting Negro athletes. This was bound to happen in the not-too-distant future. Kentucky, along with a couple of other three universities in the conference, having the doormats of their big brothers on the bottom of the Dixie Dozen. Maybe it's time that they should get out.
And so then what they simply did was to announce that they would play black athletes.
Yes.
But then apparently the scholarships were not going to kick in for another year or so.
Another
was that a
one,
legitimate,
three, 4 years.
Was that a legitimate issue? Could they have changed that? Were they stalling?
I think that was probably a legitimate issue to do
place.
It in a time and fashion that you still did have, I'm sure, some doubting Thomases and some that didn't. But if it was done in the process of normal campus activities where you did not have to change governing regulations, you did not have to change bond issues or any of that nature, you just eventually folded it in. And I think, again, though, being gone, I wish I could have been around some of the trustee meetings at that point to see. But there's one trustee that's quoted in one of these editorials, I think a fellow by the name of Sam Ezell, who was actually a labor leader. He was an AFL-CIO leader in Louisville, who was out of was a trustee, that made the comment here, it is past time that the university lived up to its moral obligation. And I thought that was interesting, too. Here you have, it's not the businessman or the professional man, it is a labor leader that was quoted. And Sam Ezell was a character. And I remember, and I used to cover some of the trustee meetings at the time. So for him to speak out was excellent.
Did you ever consider seriously staying in journalism, or were you always destined for public relations?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, in getting out, I remember my senior year, and we all would interview. I had an opportunity. Let's see, I'd interviewed with the Associated Press, and there was a night radio wire writer's job open here in Louisville. Believe it or not, the Voice of St. Matthews came back and offered me the editorship. Maybe they would pay me more than 10 cents an inch. That time, even the mayor of St. Matthews, Bernie Bowling, had called my home to see if I'd talk to him on the weekend when I was home. He wanted me to take that job. And the Cincinnati Enquirer had a place reporters. They opened. And then I had been working on campus at the time, actually before Philip Morris. And, you know, Philip Morris of the 1960s versus today with the cigarette controversy and everything. You could do those things in the 1960s. And I invited me to come to New York for an interview. And I looked at the pay scale and I looked at everything else. Except that I always liked the promotion. I think probably, you know, being an editor, you have to be a writer and you can do those things. It's also putting all the pieces together to make it work. It was making sure that, you know, the AP did get that story. It was making sure that we got it out through and got John Atkins to concur with it. And some other things I was doing and probably didn't know it. And my position on this issue outside the market. So the first end of it and being able to plan and execute and create different programs was exciting. And Philip Morris offered me the chance to come to New York. And I took it. And the rest of it's history. I still have a proud bond to the journalism profession. I'm the only public relations executive or professional that ever served as the president of the local the Society of Professional Draft. Because I maintained that membership since I was in school. I couldn't tell you that it would only end. But I was able to participate in that. And still, technically, I'm still serving that way. I'm president of the Journalism Alumni Association at UK. And by being in that position, I chair the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame selection committee. So I still think there's a very close relationship between the professions. We just look at things a little bit differently, but I can enjoy wearing outfits. But I've never wanted anybody to think I was never officially on the news side of the equation. I've always been on the side.
Well, do you think there's anything we've missed on the story of the current life of Roy?
Well, there probably is. it's about time. I should probably go through these to myself. Here's a quote. But I was at the fire on Sammy Zell. Some of the Athletic Association directors were going to meet. And Sammy Zell was going to let's say they don't do something I actually think we should. As a trustee, I commented at yesterday's meeting, it's about time we redid our policy, integrated education and segregated athletics. So it was an interesting time, a proud time for the Colonel, and a proud time for the University of Kentucky. And I'm just glad that school did. It's still standing there. I covered most of it.